by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Well, we've got one of the finest guests we've ever had with us this evening, and he's out of Missouri, Columbia, Missouri, and his name is Stephen Starr, and by gosh, he's got such, he's a senior scientist for Physicians for Social Responsibility and director of the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Missouri there in Columbia. He's published in the Bulletin and Atomic Scientist and the Strategic Arms Reduction website of the Moscow Institute of Physics and Technology. And he has a website on the environmental consequences of nuclear war at www.nucleardarkness.org. Welcome to our program, Stephen Starr.
Thanks, George. I'm glad to speak with you.
Boy, I tell you what, you've written really a fine article here in the Global Research site there out of Canada. And was there anything you wanted to add to some of your background or your experience for our listening audience?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, that was a fine introduction. I worked at the UN for several years as an expert witness for testifying on some side panels with Switzerland and New Zealand and Chile about the environmental consequences of the nuclear war and the dangers of launch-ready nuclear weapons. The U.S. and Russia still have, about something like 1,800 strategic nuclear warheads in total that each side's got close to 1,000, say 900, that they can launch in a matter of just a few minutes. And everything that I've learned has taught me that those are like a self-destruct mechanism for the human race. So that's what motivated me to do a lot of this. I just have felt, a real need to try to get the information about this out. There were some recent studies that were done. Well, they're not quite so recent now, but they began 2006 and 2007. And so the information's been out for 6 or 7, 8 years now, but we can't seem to get any of the leaders of the nuclear weapon states to publicly acknowledge or discuss this information that shows that even just a tiny fraction of the detonation of these arsenals in conflict could literally just kill about every person on the planet, because it would so disrupt global weather with the environmental consequences, it would actually create a global stratospheric smoke layer that would surround the Earth and block sunlight and produce just incredibly cold temperatures in a matter of weeks. It would last for up to 10 years. And I'm getting ahead of myself here, but that was my motivation for doing all this, was that when I read these studies, I thought, well, you know, there's a defining moment in your life where you think, I need to do something, and that was it for me. And so everything that's been going on now with the U.S. and Russia and NATO is been very upsetting to me in light of what I know about what the consequences of nuclear war would be. And, you know, it's just, it's really crazy, basically. So I appreciate the chance to talk about it. And I hope when people hear this, they'll feel it important enough to do something besides just kind of groan and go on with their daily work.
Right. This is an important article and an important point in time and a very dangerous one. You've written an article and with your description on the wrap-up, the Russian Aggression Prevention Act, that's being considered by Congress right at this time. And you're saying that, boy, we're entering into a very dangerous period, and especially one in confronting Russia at this point in time. How would you elaborate on that? Would you say that's accurate?
Yes, I've heard different things about the possibility of this, the Russian Aggression Prevention Act actually being passed right now. A lot of people say there's a low probability of that. But, you know, all it will take really is some event, you know, that's highly publicized that can get the, allow us to be pushed through Congress and signed by Obama. And, you know, what this act does is it would make Ukraine, and the Republic of Georgia and another Moldova, to be what they call major non-NATO allies of the United States. So in effect, they would become, they'd have almost the equivalent of NATO membership. You know, NATO is the military organization that was, that got started right after World War II, North Atlantic Treaty Organization that now includes, you know, most, not only Western, but Eastern European nations, some of those that were part of the former Soviet military alliance, the Warsaw Pact, and NATO is, you know, expanded up to the borders of Russia. That's really at the crux of a lot of what's going on right now. And, but Ukraine is kind of the red line. Ukraine and Georgia are the two countries where Russia has for quite a few years now said we will not accept, you know, NATO bases on our border right there. I mean, I think if the shoe was on the other foot and say Russia had a military alliance in Central America with countries in Central America, and there's a civil war going on in Mexico, and Russia was getting ready to, you know, wanted to push to get Mexico as part of their alliance and put, you know, missile bases on our border. I don't think the United States would accept that. And, you know, we don't seem, you know, we don't seem to be able to look at it from the perspective of Russia. But, you know, how many people in your listening audience, I mean, even, we care enough to risk some kind of nuclear war with Russia over some place that they probably can't find on a map? I mean, I think about all the problems we have in the United States right now. And, you know, I don't think we get the truth from the government on a lot of things. If you calculate unemployment the same way they did in the 1980s, not using the new methods that the current administration uses, we would have about a 23% unemployment rate right now. And if you, you know, you looked at inflation and calculated it the way previously it was calculated, it'd be more like 7 or 8%. And you can see that every time you go to the grocery store and the food prices. And we got a lot of problems here. And, you know, we've offshored our industry. And so that's part of the reason why, you know, people don't have jobs. You know, what's a bigger danger, the corporations that send all our, the politicians that allow them to send all our jobs to overseas, Southeast Asia and China, or Russia and Ukraine? I don't know. I just, you know.
It is getting dangerous. And just in May, there was a meeting. The Bilderberg met over in, Denmark, you know, and Copenhagen. And General Breedlove was briefing them over there along with the Supreme Commander of NATO. And then all of a sudden in June, Brzezinski's talking very aggressive about arming the Ukrainians with anti-tank weapons and anti-aircraft and so forth.
And so Breedlove, he's the head of the Joint Chiefs, right?
Yes, he is. And he was seen by Charlie Skelton. There's a photograph that we have on our site of him coming out of the, meeting over there, the Bilderberg meeting. And then all of a sudden, a month later, just a few weeks later, Brzezinski's saying, boy, we've got to arm the Ukrainians with all these anti-tank weapons.
Yeah, well, these guys, you know.
They've got a big plan, don't they?
It goes back to the Wolfowitz doctrine and, you know, and George W. Bush administration and, you know, these neocons. And neocon, you know, we got a lot of these fancy terms, but if you look at the way they operate, I mean, you know, previously they would have probably been defined as Nazis. You know, I'm sorry,
but
if you look at what they're doing.
Maybe they brought them over here after World War II. I mean, maybe they're still in power.
Well, we did just
say
that was Werner von Braun. You know, maybe I'm getting a little too outspoken here, but the problem is the way I see it is what is the point in pushing Russia up to the wall and threatening them militarily? I mean, what do they think is going to happen? I can't see that the administration is thinking more than sometimes I think they just assume if we threaten Russia enough, they're going to back down. But, you know, I've studied Russian military doctrine as part of my trying to understand about nuclear weapons. They have what they call a theory of nuclear de-escalation. And this is written out in Russian military policy. If they're confronted with overwhelming conventional force, and they wrote this in reaction to what was going on in Kosovo with NATO in the 1990s, their doctrine tells them that they will preemptively use, you know, what we used to call tactical nuclear weapons to stop, you know, because, so if Russia uses, say we got in a shooting war with NATO and Russian forces, and so then what happens? You know, if Russia is losing, although I kind of doubt it, you know, but let's just say the first scenario is Russia is losing to NATO. Do you really think they're going to allow a defeat on their border? No, they're going to say, okay, well, let's use some nuclear weapons and stop them. Then what happens? You know, NATO, the U.S. has forward-based nuclear weapons in about five or six NATO, I think it's five NATO member states at six bases. And if we get into war with Russia, then they turn those over to the NATO military members. So there, it's a tit for tat. You know, the only time we've ever used nuclear weapons in war was, of course, at the end of World War II, and we dropped them on Japan, and Japan obviously wasn't a nuclear weapon state. But, if we're we're talking about fighting a war with another, with a nuclear weapon state that's got, Russia's got something like 8,000 or 9,000 operational nuclear weapons. And the U.S. and Russia together have about 93% to 95% of all the nuclear weapons in the world. Each side's got many thousands of nuclear weapons that are ready to use right now. And I don't hear any discussion in the press. I don't see any talk about what the ramifications of a military conflict with Russia would be. In fact, I mean, I don't see any discussion of any of this, and that's one of the things that bothers me the most, because I think our media has just become almost a ministry of propaganda for the, you know, I don't see discussion about it. I always see right now, this week, they had the New York Times and the Washington Post coming out talking once again saying, Russia sent 1,000 troops into Ukraine and, you know, it's another aggression and we're going to have to react. And I see very little proof of this, and I see no debate about it in the American media. And that scares me, because, I mean, it's like an echo chamber here.
You know, the expansion of NATO with the former Soviet bloc countries right up to the door, you know, front door of Russia, I think personally was a mistake. I think they should have pursued some kind of neutral type of status. And that way it wouldn't have threatened Russia and made them paranoid about. And especially now they have this ballistic missile defense. I mean, that's getting very dangerous. And Russia is drawing a line. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well,
that they're going to say, you go across this, we might preemptive attack you. Huh?
Well, you identified the two key issues here with the deployment of U.S. ballistic missile defense and the expansion of NATO in terms of what Russia sees as a primary threat. I think they see that as a strategic threat. Now, and Russia doesn't call it missile defense. They classify it as an offensive system. Well, maybe that doesn't make any sense to some of your listeners, but if you think about it this way, say you're a Russian war planner and you're looking at what the U.S. and NATO is doing, and you have to plan for a worst-case scenario. So if the U.S. were to launch a first strike against Russia, a nuclear first strike designed to destroy 100% of their nuclear weapons, and, you know, nowadays everybody knows where the land-based silos are, and Russia has multiple ICBMs that some regiments that they can put on highways and stuff. But, you know, if you really truly launch a first strike, you could probably get 90% plus of their land-based weapons. So under those circumstances, if you use your missile defense system as a mop-up system to take out the remaining, surviving Russian nuclear forces, that's how Russia has to look at it. And so, there was an article called The Basis of Russian Technical Concerns about Missile Defense. It was written at MIT by a scientist named Fyodor Postol some years ago. But he analyzed this, and he showed that when we forward base these weapons, there's a missile site in Poland, I think there's Romania, Bulgaria, there's some in progress, I think there's going to be one in Turkey, and there's also going to be Aegis missile defense systems that are based in the Mediterranean and the North Sea and places. So we're kind of surrounding Russia with these. But Postol showed that, he did the math and showed that they could, intercept Russian ICBMs in the boost phase, they call it. When a missile first takes off, that's the slowest part of its flight, and it leaves a big thermal signature. It's easy to find. So if you put these hypersonic missile interceptors there that can go fast enough to hit the ICBMs, then, you know, you've got from the Russian point of view, that's a strategic threat, because it, you would say that degrades their deterrent, their nuclear deterrent. So, yeah, so the Russians have been very concerned about this. The new START treaty, the Strategic Arms Reduction Talks treaty that was negotiated and signed, Obama signed it. The Russians, after it was signed, they put it in writing and said, now, if you progress with the ballistic missile defenses, as you have said you will, we will withdraw from New START because at a certain point it's going to become a threat to us. Well, you know, there's obviously no concern about that now in the U.S., but that's part of the picture of what's going on. And then you combine that with NATO and, you know, putting these bases on their border. And some of the former Russian, the Soviet republics, you know, Poland and the Baltic states, they're very anti. I mean, the Poles are really, just today they were, they sort of slowed down. They were going to deny the Soviet, I think, the defense chief or one of their high ranking military officers said, you can't fly over Poland. You know, there's all sorts of, Poland's pushing for permanent NATO bases. There are troops being based in Poland. There's a lot of stuff going on, and they've already moved a lot of, American forces and fighter jets and stuff into Eastern Europe. So there is a buildup that's been going on. It's, you know, ordinary people don't keep track of this because it's hard enough just to pay the bills and deal with your day-to-day problems without trying to worry about what NATO is doing. But, you know, I've kind of had a fixation on this because of my concern about nuclear war. So I'm very worried about what's going on. I don't understand why the Obama administration feels so obligated to just, you know, it's all we hear about is Putin, 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 and Ukraine. But like I said earlier, we've got so many problems here in the United States that need to be addressed domestically. The elementary school that my kids went to is 100 years old, and they have to close it because there's no air conditioning. But they want to spend another $50 billion here and there, you know. I mean, it's crazy. It's like Washington, there's no relation to what, you know, the needs of the people.
They're really
are
out of touch, aren't they? They've fallen off the end of the deal. They're just not in touch with the American public anymore. Do you think it's that press? They listen to their own media, you know, and their own hype too much, you know?
Obama's, they won't even meet with guys like Henry Kissinger and stuff, people that, you know, former presidents. They don't want any advice. Obama's, he's like abdicated his, you know, he's at the golf course most of the time, from what I can hear.
Yeah, he has. Now, just recently, Putin has made a statement at a youth conference that don't mess with Russia. We're a nuclear power, and you just don't want to mess with Russia. That's very threatening, it sounded like to me.
Well, I think, you know, at some level, you have to remember that, you know, he's got his own domestic critics. Imagine if you were... if you're Putin and you've got hawks there too. And right now you've got, because Eastern Ukraine used to be, was part of Russia for 200 years. It was from 1780s to about 1954. And only then, Ukraine was handed over. The Eastern Ukraine was made part of Ukraine by Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian. But, the cities there were part of the Soviet military industrial complex. They're actually the biggest industrial part of what has been Ukraine up till now. And most of the people there speak Russian are ethnic Russians. It's really historically been part of Russia. So they're watching, you know, and look at what Kiev, these guys that took over, that had basically a coup there that we supported, that took over the government in Kiev. One of the first things they did was pass laws rescinding their right to use Russian as a language there. And a lot of things happened. So the people in eastern Ukraine said, well, you know, we don't want to be part of Ukraine anymore. We want to have what they call a federation. Germany has this. They just wanted to have like an autonomous republic of, you know, Donbass, or, you know, they defined this in a way where they would technically be part of Ukraine, but they would have elect their own government and all that. Well, the government in Kiev said, well, no way. And then eventually they defined them as terrorists. And so what they sent their military, and they're bombarding these cities. You know, if people read that article, some of the things we're not hearing in the news now is that the Ukrainian military surrounded Donetsk, that's a city of about 1 million people, and Lugansk, a city of more than 400,000 people, and they're shelling them for months. They bombard them with inaccurate rocket launchers, heavy artillery. They drop bombs from airplanes, and they've killed thousands of people. And the UN High Commissioner said that there's 740,000 of these people that have fled these cities and gone into Russia. They go there because Russia's close and they speak the Russian language. This is what we would call ethnic cleansing. And the people that are running the government in Kiev are okay with that. They hate the Russians. You know, Western Ukraine was actually fought with the Nazis in World War II against the Soviet Union. They hate the Russians. I mean, historically, they have some reason to hate Russia because a lot of Ukrainians starved to death when Stalin was in power. But bottom line is, these guys, some of the people they sent, some of the battalions that the Ukrainian military has sent actually fly Nazi flags. They fly the Wolf Hooks flag that Hitler's SS brigades flew. And so when the Russians see this, and they see these guys flying Nazi flags attacking ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine, can you imagine what Putin is hearing at home? They're saying, why won't you defend our people? Why won't you go in there and stop this? Because Russia could stop it quickly. They don't have to invade. They can send their air force in and knock these guys out. That's why I laugh when I hear these reports from the Pentagon and the White House saying, oh, Russia sent 1,000 troops and they've invaded. That's a joke. If they wanted to invade Ukraine, they could. Poroshenko, the leader in Ukraine, will know if he's being invaded because he's going to be in a bunker trying to get a line out somewhere. You know, I'm just saying, though, that Putin's under a lot of domestic pressure to have a military intervention. And I didn't wonder if that is that the point? Is that the point of pushing, you know, but these people are being, you know, it's slaughter over there. It's terrible what's going on. We don't hear about it in the news. How many of your listeners have heard about Donetsk and Lugansk and all these attacks that are going on every day? I don't see it in any of the news I see here in the Midwest.
The alternative press is coming out with some of that stuff now, but what Samantha Power is saying at the UN, there being our ambassador to the UN, is just propaganda, you know?
Well, yeah. She said, the Russians have to stop lying.
Yeah, you got to remember, she's married to Cass Sunstein. He was communications czar in the White House, and he put out this deal about, let's go break up the 9/11 truth movement through infiltration. See what I mean? So, I mean, those are the kind of people that we've got running our government up here, you know?
Well, Obama...
And wife now can propagandize together, I guess. I don't know. See?
I don't know.
It's crazy, you know?
A lot of people have tried to hang on to the idea that Obama was a liberal, and he gave that speech in 2009, I guess it was, about, you know, having a world free of nuclear weapons and... But look at what he's doing. The Cold War has come back in force under Obama, and he's letting these neocons in the State Department, the Pentagon, basically, push us into a very dangerous situation. It's reckless to make these continual threats. And what is it? You know, I mean, I see some of the stuff the U.S. accuses Russia of. They're coming out with no proof. They claim that, Russia was bombarding Ukraine with their artillery a couple weeks ago, and then they wouldn't release any photographs, and finally the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine released them on his, like, Facebook or Twitter account or something. I mean, that's a joke. And that, what that tells me is they don't have any evidence. The latest evidence that they're supposed to have to show these Russian artillery movements comes from some private satellite company that, I don't know, they get these photos from, and it's...
Well, the reason why, you know, they're putting up stuff like that is because we have a special agency that's bigger, they say, than other agencies in our United States intelligence community. It knows whether or not what's going on. They just don't want to go to it because it would be the truth, right?
Yeah, well, I guess what I was trying to say is that if they really have strong evidence of this, they certainly haven't brought it forth. And it's more like innuendo and insinuation is all that's required. You know, and the way the press works now, England is basically our partner in this, so the BBC is going to parrot whatever's going on. And for example, that airliner that was shot down, the Malaysian airliner, immediately we announced that the Russians did it, or the Russians are responsible, the Russian separatists. And now there's no discussion about that, but there's been a bunch of evidence that's come out that showed that, you know, there's a couple of plausible theories that it could have been the Ukrainian Air Force that shot it down. But the way there seems to be no memory, there's no discussion. It's just, I think the strategy is if you just come out with enough demonization and accusations long enough, it creates this general impression of Russia as the ultimate bad guys and Putin as, you know, Satan. And this is how you build up to war, to justify military intervention. But what happens after that? I mean, you know, sure, they can attack Russia, but what do you think is going to happen? You think Russia's going to surrender? So this is just crazy. It's really, what I know about nuclear war tells me that any significant use of Russian or American nuclear arsenals in conflict is going to kill most of the people on the planet. Not right away, but within a few years, because what'll happen is the smoke that would be created, even the peer-reviewed studies that I've been discussing at the UN, predict that, you know, the nuclear firestorms from nuclear detonations would put so much smoke, it would put literally tens of millions of tons of smoke above cloud level into the stratosphere. And there's high winds up there, so in a matter of a couple of weeks, the smoke spreads around the Earth, and then it would block up to 70% of the sunlight from reaching the northern hemisphere for 10 years or longer. That's what those studies. These are good studies. These are state-of-the-art computer models. These studies were published in, you know, high-powered scientific journals, and they were reviewed for a year, and there were no flaws or corrections that had to be made, and they've been published for some years, and they can't find anything wrong with them. So, you know, if you block that much sunlight, you make it, the average daily temperatures would be below freezing every single day for 3 years in Central Europe and the United States. You can't grow anything if it's below freezing every day, you know, in the summer. And so you would have no growing seasons for up to 10 years or longer. And, you know, we have our total global grain reserves right now are enough to feed everybody on the planet for, you know, maybe a couple of months. They even did a study showing a war between India and Pakistan with half of their operational arsenals, which would be, they've got 200 atomic bombs that can drop over there now. If they detonated 100 of those in their large cities, it would put up enough smoke to block 7 to 10% of the sunlight in the northern hemisphere. Well, that would produce the coldest average temperatures in the last 1,000 years. And it would really drop, you know, corn and soybean production down here. You wouldn't be able to grow wheat in Canada. Rice production in China would drop way down, and there's studies in all this. So don't you think, I mean, in a sane world, this is what our leaders should be talking about, saying, look, you know, these scientists, these are our best scientists, have shown that nuclear war is suicide. So we need to get rid of these weapons. But instead of that, they won't acknowledge or discuss this. Instead, they're pushing us towards war with Russia. So I'm very concerned about this, and I hope people will take the time to just, you don't have to be an expert on this to be able to say what we don't want this. So
we have a click off globalresearch.ca. That's where your article is. They can come into thesecrettruth.com and then click directly on the hypertext link and go directly to that article. What's disturbing also, Stephen, story is that the Crimea in this wrap-up, isn't there a part in there about Crimea? And within 7 days of the enactment of that act, the wrap-up, they are demanding that Russia pull out or whatever to withdraw.
Right.
Isn't that crazy? That's not even realistic.
Yeah. Again, this gets back to the whole issue of NATO expansion into Ukraine. Crimea is where Russia's had one of their biggest naval bases. It's their only what they call a warm water port, which means it doesn't freeze in the winter. And, you know, if Ukraine would have joined NATO, before, you know, all this happened with the, that would have, you know, before Crimea was to said, okay, we don't want to have anything to do with this and voted to join Russia again. But they would, Russia would have been required to, leave that NATO, that naval base if NATO came in. And Russia wasn't about to do that because that's kind of like the U.S. having to leave, you know, Chesapeake Bay or something from the Russian point of view. But this is still the heart of the matter. The Russian Aggression Prevention Act, and the Republicans in Congress and the people that are pushing this are, that's part of the act. So we will not recognize that, Crimea has rejoined Russia. And so therefore, you know, if this act is passed and it will require, it'll have sanctions against anybody that recognizes this. And therefore, you know, it's very unrealistic because it's pretty much, it's telling the Russians they have to leave or else, there'll be trouble basically. And Russia is of course not going to leave there. But the bigger, you know, one of the things I mentioned on the article, that I'm very concerned about is that Ukraine right now is mobilizing they're in their third force mobilization and they had over a million people in their reserves. So they're trying to get a million people in their standing army. They're bringing, and they were a weapons dump for the Soviet Union. They had something like 1,400 tanks in storage. They had all kinds of aircraft. So they're bringing all this equipment out of storage. They're refurbishing it. They're drafting everybody in the country. And the Russian Aggression Prevention Act, if we pass that, immediately would have Obama send them $100 million in military equipment to supplement, you know, to arm this army that, the best sources I could find, and I don't know if they're accurate or not, but this is what Putin's advisors are telling him, saying that Ukraine would have up to 500,000 men in their army by the first part of next year. So if RAPA was passed, and then we would be sending them $100 million of arms. And it's the Ukrainian stated policy now, Kiev's policy, that they will, retake Crimea. And their new defense minister had a speech before their parliament and said, we're going to have a victory march in Sevastopol. That's where the Russian naval base is in Crimea. So they're saying, we're going to invade. You know, if we get our army big enough and ready to go, we're going to go down and invade Crimea. Well, that would be an invasion of Russia from Russians' point of view. So at that point, Russia couldn't stay out of the war. I mean, some people say, well, they're already in it, but I dispute that. I think if Russia was in this, I wouldn't be surprised, honestly, if Russia is supplying weapons to the separatists. You know, this is clearly a proxy war. I mean, we certainly are supplying, lots of financial aid. We're buying the bullets for Kiev at this point. So that's what's happened. Obama's got this down to where we actually have kind of a proxy war with Russia going on the border of Russia and Ukraine. And it's just getting worse every day. And it scares the hell out of me because
these are the way things happen. They just start building up slowly and each side begins to arm and pull and call people into the army and drafting conscription and all that. Before you know it, they've got a bunch of people under arms ready to go, right?
Yeah, well, it's
and that's where we're proceeding on this. You know, now the Russians are drawing a line, and then the Americans are coming up with this RAPA thing that doesn't make any sense. And now, are our strategic security interests really in jeopardy right there in the Ukraine or not? What do you think?
Well, I think that Russia, you know, if you look at the history of Russia,
yeah,
and the Soviet Union, they were invaded twice in the 20th century. In World War II, Russia lost something up as many as 27 million Russians were killed. The lowest number that I've read is 20 million. Every family lost people. And, you know, so they have a very vivid memories of fighting the Nazis. We had, of 500,000 people killed in World War II. So, I mean, the Russians were the ones that beat the Nazis. And they destroyed their armies and they suffered immensely. And that was part of the reason they set up, you know, those Soviet republics as a buffer zone to prevent invasion again. And they, we promised them, Clinton promised them, and well, actually Clinton was the one that broke it. It was, I think George Bush, the first President Bush and Reagan had promised that we would not expand NATO eastward. And so they allowed Germany to be reunified without violence. And but we broke that promise, and we expanded NATO all the way to the Russian border. So the Russians see this now as this huge military alliance, NATO, which is also now conducting military operations in Africa. And, you know, they view it, and it's not just the Russian government. The Russian people see NATO as a threat. And if you look at the polls, they're very much behind Putin. He has like a 71% approval rate. It's like it's a little better than what Obama has right now, I think. So they see this as a threat, and they are not going to just accept it. And why is this? I don't understand why that. This is only a threat to us in terms of plans to try to dominate every country in the world. The Wolfowitz doctrine the neocons thrive on is basically saying that they will not accept Russia and China as world. They have to be suppressed so the United States could be the sole superpower. And Russia is not accepting that. So that if it's a strategic threat, it's only a strategic threat to the Wolfowitz doctrine. But, I mean, like I said before, if you look at the problems we have here in the United States today, and there are many, you know, I mean, just.
Well, you know, what's happened is Brzezinski's strategy and so forth, it's been in place since Carter, right? He had driven the Soviets into alliances with India and China with BRICS and all that other stuff. It's
right.
Undermining our influence of Russia. And at one time, is it true that Russia was going to join in to NATO at some point?
Well, yeah, Russia, I think at the end of it, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and we had that period in the early 90s, Russia fully expected to be a partner and be a strategic partner, but they were never treated that way, regardless of what the PR line was. And, you know, I listen to Paul, or read Paul Craig Roberts a lot. I like his oral interviews, too, and he's very well-spoken. And,
yes, he is. Yes.
And he talks about how stupid it is, the policy that we've pursued now, because we've driven Russia into a major strategic partnership with China and India. They're abandoning the use of the dollar. And really, a lot of this gets back to the dollar as a global reserve currency. You know, I mean, I know it's not exactly nuclear weapons talk here, but, you know, the only way you can hurt a country with sanctions is if they use the dollar in trade. And so what have we done? We're eliminating that use by, you know, we've got the BRICS nations working together. I think that's 40% of the world's population, and it's something like 20% of the trade. And the way things are going, we're just totally shooting ourselves in the foot by this, because we don't make stuff here anymore. You know, we have to import our stuff from, because we're in China. That's one of the countries we're threatening right now. Suppose they say, okay, well, you know, we're not going to take dollars anymore. You're going to have to convert that to our currency. And by the way, you know, our exchange rate we'll give you a 30% of what we did before for. Our prices at home are going to triple and quadruple. That's when inflation's going to hit.
Now, that's what's going to happen in this country, is that our food costs have already started going up. And
there's
going to be other acceleration and inflation of other costs. That's where we're going to lose out, because the dollar will decline because of our inflation rate, you know, increasing on all the cost of all the
right. Well, it's just that we see that now, because what's happening is people that are seeing what's, you know, you can't just create trillions and trillions of dollars to pay your bills with, you know, they call it unsterilized, you know, when you just print money or create it electronically to pay your bills.
Quantitative easing is the term.
Quantitative easing,
yeah. And that's what they've been doing. They say that our Fed, they had to have control of our Fed, the internationalists, to save their international financial institutions. That's what they've done.
Well, the Federal Reserve was probably the worst thing we ever did here.
It is. It is. And Woodrow Wilson brought it in. And there was a fellow right out of Austin, House, by the name of House, that was instrumental in bringing it in and establishing the Council on Foreign Relations also in 22. So after that.
But, you know, if the Federal Reserve basically has the ability to create money, and they're privately owned, despite their title makes it sound like it's part of the federal government, but they're not.
No.
And, you know, if you have the ability to create unlimited money, then you basically have unlimited power. And I think that's been used to corrupt almost every institution in the U.S., you know. And plus, if you look at the history of this, the executive branch has slowly but surely taken over all the power. The judicial and the legislative really don't, they rubber stamp what's going on. And then, you know, with 9/11 and the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, it threw the Constitution out the window. And in my mind, the United States, the Constitution is the United States. So we, you know, people need to understand we don't have a democratic republic here anymore.
Well, they've been trying. The idea that I've been fighting and talking about is that they tried to make and create the idea that the Constitution, U.S. Constitution, should be a living, breathing document and should change. But when you make that idea and put that forward, then it can die. And it's being attacked in a lot of different ways. And I'm a strict constructionist type person on the Constitution.
Oh, yeah, well.
And that's where the Tea Party and there's a lot of other people have come back in and trying to get back to the original intent.
Well, I mean, you're like a constitutional party, really.
Yeah, you know, well,
we need to restore the Constitution in the United States.
They've had some by that name before.
I don't know. They can call it whatever they want, but, I mean, yeah. If we're going to, you know, the only way we can use law to protect our citizenry is to restore the Constitution. And when the president takes an oath of office to preserve and protect the Constitution, then signs one document after another destroying it, then I consider that. That's if you can't get impeached for that, what can you get impeached for?
Right. You know, it reminds me, you remember the end of Rome was it, they went through an imperial Rome, a period of imperial Rome, they call it. And that's when all of these emperors thought themselves as gods.
See? Yeah, well, I think.
So these people in Congress, I think that they're, you could picture them in robes. You know what I mean? And they're thinking themselves as gods. They're destroying everything, sounds like.
The people that are making decisions are not making them based on what ordinary people like us want.
That's right.
It's a very select, small group of very powerful interest groups that you know, pay the money and get listened to. And, you know, the corporations really have gotten so much power. When the Supreme Court said corporations are basically people, that was a joke, but that's...
Yes, and then this unlimited contribution from corporations.
Yeah.
That just,
I mean, really, you know,
mean,
so look
where
at
that coming from?
Income distribution in the United States is we're like what we when I was a kid we used to joke about banana republics. Well, guess what? We're there.
Exactly. I mean, when you have a Supreme Court that can't make a decision on corporate funding of political things in a sensical way, you know, common sense way, then I mean they've been bought off. See.
Right.
But
I want to, we started talking about, I mean, with RAPA and nuclear weapons, I just want to, I want people to fully understand that, you know, a few takeaway sentences is that nuclear war is suicide for the human race. And this can happen. It doesn't even have to be the U.S. If Russia launched the first strike, that would do it. Or if the U.S. launches a first strike, that would do it. And the leaders need to be held to account. They need, because the information has been out there for a long time. I actually made a presentation at the United Nations about 3 or 4 years ago, and I did a 10-minute audiovisual in front of the whole General Assembly trying to explain this. So the ambassador from every nation in the world was there. It's not a mystery. It's not, the knowledge is out there. It's just, but unless we get, we really need somebody to have enough courage or sense to stand up, and preferably one of the leaders of the nuclear weapons states, and say, look, we got to do something about this. We can't allow a nuclear war to take place because it's just going to kill everybody on the planet. And you know, I don't know, you know, who it's going to take to do that, but anybody that's got enough sense to do that is going to get my vote. You know, because that's where we got to start. We got to get... And we need to hold our own leaders to account on this. We need to get them to not just blow us off and say, oh, well, you know, don't worry. We understand all this. But they don't. The U.S. and Russia had simultaneously had large nuclear war games in May because of what's going on in Ukraine. They're rehearsing for nuclear war, in my opinion. So, they'll say, oh, well, this is to prevent nuclear war. But, you know, it's... I don't believe that. I think that, you know, that somehow the people that are in charge seem to get the idea that they can win this, or else why would they push it to the wall like this? I don't know.
Right. That nuclear industry, it still has those nuclear power plants, and this Fukushima, do you have any recent information or updates on Fukushima? That thing is just spewing forth radiation left and right. I mean, is there any solution to this thing?
Well, as far as Fukushima goes, the cores and all those reactors melted down and melted through the containment vessels into the earth. And they are so radioactive that they don't even know exactly where they are, because not only cannot people can't get close to it without dying, but they can't even send robots in there. It destroys the robots almost. The gamma radiation coming off the massive melted fuel that's down there, each one of those reactor cores, is so intense that you can't even get close to it with a machine to look at it. And so, meanwhile, every day since the accident's taken place, something like 300 to 600 tons of groundwater becomes contaminated and flows out in the Pacific Ocean. And this is not going to stop. They were going to try to build some frozen wall around it, but it didn't work. You know, I didn't think it would probably. I don't know if there's any simple solution to it, but what I would like to say is that we still are busy piling up nuclear waste at every single one of our power plants here in the U.S. and the other 300 plants around the world, the spent fuel pools, you know, the reactors don't have a long-term storage site to send their fuel to, so they keep it in like a swimming pool next to the reactor, and the pool is actually outside the containment vessel at every commercial power plant. And the nuclear power plants produce much more long-lived radionuclides radiation than the nuclear detonation. So there's a huge amount of the most isotope that's most talked about is cesium-137. It's about 40% of the radiation in the spent fuel pools comes from that. And in one spent fuel pool, there's something like 3 to 5 times more cesium-137 than was released by all the above-ground nuclear weapons tests combined, of well over 1,000 nuclear detonations, and many of those were, you know, multi-megaton. So that just shows you how much radiation is at these nuclear power plants. And these plants, you know, there's 15 power plants in Ukraine, for example.
My gosh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's where Chernobyl is, too, by the way. You know,
it's in the northern part of the Ukraine, wasn't it? North central, I'm thinking.
So, yeah. You know, this is another problem that never gets talked about. When they build all these plants, nobody ever talks about what might happen to them during a war. You know, because there's always assumptions like, well, everything's going to be fine, and nobody would do that. But, you know, people are crazy, and you give people weapons, and they start fighting, and it's hard to tell what's going to happen. So this is a serious problem that we have, even in the United States. The electromagnetic pulse from a high altitude nuclear detonation will destroy the integrated circuits of just everything, you know, the transistors in, you know, cars or, you know, you name it, anything that's around will get fried for tens of thousands of square miles. And so if you had this over the East Coast, you could probably melt down several dozen nuclear power plants at the same time. So that's a problem that doesn't get talked about very often. So that means what we need to do there is to get as much waste out of these pools that's sitting there now. So the waste has to be constantly cooled. They have to have a cooling system going 24/7 at each one of these spent fuel pools. But they have at least as much as 2/3 of the waste has been in there long enough where it could be removed and put in what they call dry cast storage. And it should be hardened and probably kept underground on site there until a permanent underground repository can be set up. We've got to get the stuff off the surface because, you know, we've created a problem that this waste is going to be toxic for up to 1 million years, at least 100,000 years. It has to be isolated from the environment. And, you know, you can't count on surface conditions to be stable for 100,000 years at all. That's a time frame that's kind of beyond comprehension. So this is another problem. You know, again, so instead of sending billions of dollars for NATO weapons, we need to take some of this money and fix some of these problems we have here at home while we can.
Stephen Starr, you're right on it. You know, there are these big transformers that make up and connect a lot of our high voltage systems. And if they get knocked out by EMP, you can't replace them that quickly. So then if the power's down, then the nuclear plants lose power. They can only operate for so long on generators to cool their – then you've got massive meltdowns in a lot of them, you think?
Yeah, that's true. At least up until recently, most commercial sites only had about 6 days worth of diesel fuel on site to run their generators. But the generators weren't designed to run long term. And the generators have to run in order to run these cooling systems. You know, a nuclear power plant, the fission that takes place in the reactor core generates so much heat that, even if you shut the plant down, it takes a certain, it takes usually weeks to, maybe a month or so before the fission reaction starts to subside enough that you don't have to have these, the cooling system has to keep going even after you shut it down. Let's just put it that way.
Right.
And these are big systems. The generators that they use are water cooled, So you can't just turn these things off. But there's always been the assumption that the off-site power would be available and maybe short-term disruptions. Well, in Japan when they had the earthquake and tsunami, it just totally wrecked. I mean, the tsunami went miles inland and destroyed the power lines and everything else and the highways. And it also destroyed the water intakes for the cooling system at the power plant. So they were going to melt down regardless. But, here in Missouri, they have a Madrid fault that made the Mississippi River run backwards in the early 19th century.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That new Madrid, remember?
Right. And,
new Madrid earthquake, yeah.
But supposedly our nuclear power plant here in Callaway is built to withstand a quake. That it was centered down there in the Boot Heel, but, if it destroyed the entire grid, then we'd have another problem. It's like you still have to have electricity. So these are the kind of things that, keep me up at night, even though, I also worry about how I'm going to pay my bills, too. I'm like everybody else.
I really worry.
I just worry so much about all this war stuff. They're beating the war drums louder and louder. It's the last thing we need right now with all the problems we have in the United States is try to get in some big fight with NATO and Russia. It's crazy.
Well, Russia's flying these nuclear bombers closer to our international borders, are they not? And so,
well, yeah,
a little aggressive too,
It's a tit for tat. It's a tit for tat. Russia's saying you can't push us around. But I don't know.
China's doing the same, see?
If you listen to Paul Craig Roberts,
yeah.
He's saying that one of the most dangerous and stupid things you can do is to convince another nuclear power that you might attack them. Because how do you know that they won't attack you first?
Yes.
I mean, that's what we're doing with this stuff. We're threatening them every day.
Is MAD over with then, maybe, you think?
No. I mean, it's never, as long as they've had launch-ready nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
But it's just a... Actually, what's over with, the scientists wrote an article called Self-Assured Destruction. It's sad. That's what we have.
Yeah, self-assured destruction. Yeah, that's it.
when they had all that MAD stuff that they developed back in the 60s and 70s.
They didn't
understand the environmental consequences of nuclear war. They first actually came out with the real authoritative studies in the early 1980s. That was Carl Sagan and these rocket scientists, literally from NASA, that they came up with the idea of nuclear winter, and what they used then would be considered primitive now, but they were still using the best computers that they had back then at NASA to show that the smoke created from nuclear war would block enough sunlight to create these ice age weather conditions on Earth. It would last, they thought then it would last for a year, but then the new studies they did in 2006 and 7 showed that it would last for 10 years or longer. So they have gotten rid of, we had something like 70,000 operational nuclear weapons in 1986. Right now the global arsenal is about 16,300 and about 15,000 or so of those belong to the U.S. and Russia. But I guarantee, I mean, you know, even 1,000 nuclear weapons would create just, you know, it would make it where nobody could grow any food for years. And, so that means everybody's gonna starve. And it's not just people, it's like a mass extinction event. You know, the large animals populations would be killed off. One of the scientists that I work with does a talk, and he compares the extinction of the dinosaurs with nuclear war. Because, you know, a meteor hit the Earth, they have a lot of evidence now in the Yucatan Peninsula about 60 million years ago. They made this crater that they photographed from space that's like 180 kilometers wide. It threw up, it vaporized everything in there. It threw it up above the Earth, and it rained back down into the Earth and heated the entire atmosphere to the point where the temperatures were like 600 degrees at ground level. So it sent all the forests on fire, burned everything up, killed the dinosaurs, and it made so much smoke that then it blocked enough sunlight that it was just below freezing for, you know, longer than 10 years.
My gosh.
It killed 75% of all the species on the planet and all the animals that were bigger than about the size of a squirrel.
Right.
So, I mean, so that's what a real nuclear war would be similar to that. And that's what these idiots and they're in charge of nuclear weapons are fooling around with.
Psychopaths almost. We've got about 3 minutes left. Is there any closing comments you'd like to make or anything that we left out? I mean, we covered quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, I just urge everyone to just take a few minutes out of their day to try to do something about this, you know, and not just do it once and forget about it. They got to understand that nuclear war threatens human survival. And if our leaders are not smart enough to understand that, I mean, as long as we let these guys keep modernizing and maintaining these giant arsenals of nuclear weapons, then sooner or later something's going to go wrong. You know, it's just a matter of time before they're used. You can't, I don't believe that nuclear deterrence is going to work perfectly forever, because it requires people to be logical on all sides, to be rational, and, you know, we can see that's not going to happen. So, you know, but we can do better than this. We don't have to spend all our money on war and militarism. We can, and maybe that sounds naive, I guess, but.
Well, you know, that defensive stuff, are to get to harden some of our like the transformers and some of our plants and nuclear plants. We need to concentrate on America, within the borders
right
here, you know?
Well, I do think it's a matter of priorities, and at the very least, you know, we don't need to. We'd be a lot better off if we made friends with Russia. We got a lot more in common with them than we do.
Well, you know, we had a chance to do that under JFK, but the powers that were then did not want a détente
right
with the Soviet Union.
But bottom line is,
yeah, then we had the Cold War, and now we're entering into another Cold War that could go hot, maybe, you know?
Yeah, and it's crazy. I mean, we need to make the point to our congressmen and our senators that we don't want a war with Russia. Okay, we don't want NATO over there. We don't want NATO expansion in Ukraine and Georgia. We need to just back off and, you know, I'm sorry, but why do we shouldn't be the world's policemen and think we can solve everything when we have such terrible problems at home that we're not dealing with.
And we can't afford it anymore either, can we?
Right. This imperial presidency has just lost touch with the reality of the American people.
Exactly. And that doesn't matter if they're Democrats or Republicans. They've all been becoming an imperial presidents, you know?
Right. So, you know, you got to do something about that. I'm not exactly sure, but I'd say let's restore the American Constitution.
Yes, okay, that is. Stephen Starr, thank you very much this evening for this interview. And, boy, we did touch on some things, and we got off on some strategic, atomic stuff, but, boy, that nuclear stuff, but that's what we needed to talk about.
Yeah, well, it's time to talk about it. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Stephen Starr. Bye-bye.
All right.
Good night.